Reinstate you as a Frey. I'm not sure a Fane has that power, but thank you. It means a great deal that you want to. What's it like to be, to not be, Frey? She looked sad for a moment. We thought, she paused and looked away. The Grey Cloaks thought the loss of one soul was just superstition. But then, we also believed ourselves to be gods. We were young and foolish on both counts. It's real. Margareta nodded while pressing her lips tight, as if holding back a tempest of emotion. I can feel it. This coldness. This horrible emptiness. It hit me a second after I killed Jinriel, a Gwaedri who got in the way. I was fighting a member of the Lion Corps, a soldier who ducked at the last instant. I really didn't expect to lose my soul, especially not from killing a Gwaedri. Margareta started to cry. He drew her tighter and kissed the wet of her cheeks and then her eyes. I'll make it better, I promise. You realize we could die tomorrow. It's actually a very real possibility. This could be the last night we have. She pushed farther away and rubbed her hands together, humming a simple Torsonic chant. All 12 of the braziers came to life. The bronze urns burst into blue flames that licked upward like living things. Below, the dome was cast in a wondrous indigo glow. Wanderlei smiled and added white lights. Firefly sparks that billowed and swirled. The light from them filled the chamber. Wiping away her remaining tears, Margareta raised her brows mischievously and flicked one finger. A bird of light appeared and flew in a circle around the chamber. Wanderlei found her weave and drew out a long, colorful tail that left shimmering sparks as the bird flew. For a moment, they were both that bird, intertwined and linked through the art, both flying as one. The Erenthian was no longer a dark and solemn place. It became a light show of warmth and humor. We shouldn't, he said, and loathed himself for saying it. We'll attract attention. So, she asked, that playful look turning blatantly wicked. What are you afraid of? What about the Fane's guards? What if they see the lights through the windows and come to investigate? Margareta laughed. It'd be their worst night ever, don't you think? Them with their spears, swords and shields, and us with everything else. Together, we are Venlin. Venlin. Land of hope. Is that a word? It is now. She nodded with that wonderful smile. Venlin is what we make together. A place where anything is possible. A sort of paradise. I may not be able to enter Pyre when I die, so we'll make Alison right here. Right now. We are Venlin. What should have been and what will now always be.
What about Sile and Sine? What if they come to investigate?
I'll kill them. She said in a dull, flat tone.
The words as cold and uncaring as the winter wind that could no longer reach them.
And if it was your father?
I'd do the same. I don't want anything, anyone to come between us.
Tomorrow we both might die. But tonight, yes, for this one wonderful evening, we are Fenlin.
She clapped her hands, and the entire Erenthian transformed. Plants, lush and flowered, burst forth as spring surrounded Margareta and Wanderlei. Vines snaked up the pillars, birds sang and butterflies flew.
It seems so real, he said, amazement in his voice.
That wicked smile continued as she slipped off her cloak and began to untie her assegai.
I'll show you what's true.
Chapter 13. The Door Opens. Life can surprise you. Death will astound you even more.
Trust me, I know. The Book of Bryn. Darkness. Stepping into the pond was like wading into the dark hollow of a forest, where the air felt colder for no apparent reason. Instead of feeling buoyancy or the sensation of any fluid's resistance, Bryn simply continued to walk until she seemed to reach the bottom of the pond and just stood there, stupidly. With few options, Bryn started walking again. Before too long, the ground tilted, and she was ascending an incline, perhaps the other side of the pool. She continued to walk until, at some point, the light disappeared. That should have been her first clue that something had changed. The only time Bryn had been without light since entering Pyre was during the few moments when she passed through the barrier in the Agave. Still, Bryn didn't consider herself an authority on the afterlife, so she didn't know for certain what was happening. Neither the trip down nor the one up was very long, and in a short while she found level ground again. Bryn tucked the key back under her shirt. She wasn't sure if she was clear of the pool. Bryn didn't feel any wetness, but then she never had felt anything, so it was hard to tell. Then a sound emanated from somewhere in the dark. Not a comforting noise. A growl, deep and threatening, came from not too far away, making Bryn do her best imitation of a statue.
If only I could see.
Bryn waited, expecting sounds of movement.
Will there be any? Or will the first thing I notice be the ripping of my throat? No, of course not. I don't have one.
For the first time, the lack of a body was a comfort, but a small one as she stood in the dark, listening to more growls. After several minutes of standing still, which, not surprisingly, got her nowhere, Bryn took a step, then another. Everything was still dark, and she had no idea which way she ought to go.
This is insane. Even in Nephril, even in the Abyss, it wasn't this dark. There was always a sky of sorts. And in the Abyss, I was able to use my own light. This is just frustrating.
She bent down, feeling with her hands, and found dirt. She tried to scrape up a handful to see if it was wet, sandy, or worm-filled. She was looking for any clue, and she got one. Her hands failed to move so much as a single grain. She could feel the soil, but not affect it.
The dirt is real. I'm back on Elan, and my light is gone because I'm a ghost. But why is it so dark? Where am I that there is no light at all? And if I'm a ghost, shouldn't I glow?
Meeks did.
If I can't see, what should I do next? Grandmother of all, help me, she whispered.
Instantly, lights appeared. Faintly glowing mushrooms appeared here and there. The little fungi began to light up in luminous greens, blues, and reds. Clusters materialized on the ground and grew brighter until the sacred grove emerged from the gloom and became as enchanted as the land of Nog, the real one from the stories of old. Bryn was on a patch of barren soil, and at its center stood a tree. Bryn had no idea what sort it might be. She wasn't an expert on flora, although living most of her life on the eaves of a forest gave her better knowledge than most. She cycled through every variety she knew and couldn't find anything to match the one before her. It had the friendly spread of an old oak, but the majesty of an elm or hickory. The tree was perfect in its symmetry, huge and wonderful, but it was dead. No leaves dressed it. The bark had fallen away, and several of the withered branches had cracked and fallen. Bryn looked around, bewildered. The sacred grove was supposed to be a wondrous garden, the heart of Elan, the most marvelous place in existence. This was where the greatest of all heroes came to dwell in beauty beyond even that of Alison. Having seen the former, Bryn's expectations had been high. As it turned out,
The grove wasn't just disappointing, it was puzzling, and not a garden at all. She stood in an enclosed room with a dirt floor and no visible ceiling. The sides were smooth white stone that formed a continuous circular wall, completely uniform except for a single small door that appeared to be made of wood. The only thing in the room other than herself and the pool was the very large and extremely dead tree. Bryn heard the growling again. It came from the tree. "Hello, Bryn." The words didn't come from the tree, and they didn't sound like a voice at all. They were like rushing water, wind in leaves, and the call of a loon on a summer's night.
"Hello?"
Bryn sounded small. "Do you know where you are?" The not voice was the drone of bees, the chatter of crickets, and the flutter of birds taking flight.
"The sacred grove,"
she whispered, but she didn't know why.
"Do you know who I am?"
said ice receding on a lake, the unfurling of a flower, and a cracking egg of a soon-to-be-born chick. The question was simultaneously absurd, yet perfectly reasonable. Bryn did know. That voice was as familiar to her as her own breath and heartbeat, both of which continued to be missing and sorely missed. The words spoken to Bryn were the songs by which she had lived her days, a rhythm and melody she hadn't heard in, oh, so long. They summoned memories of morning dew, dandelion tufts drifting on a breeze, sunshine glimmering on the surface of a lake. In that instant, Bryn knew who was speaking, and her strength gave out. Down she fell, plopping onto the dirt. Bryn quivered in shock and amazement, and answered,
"You are Elan, the grandmother of all.
It's good to have you back. I've missed you. I doubt you remember when we first met. You were so small. Such a tiny thing. Now look at you.
I'm still small."
At that moment, Bryn had never felt so insignificant.
"Bah,"
responded the sound of a sheep, and Bryn knew she would never hear a bleat the same way again.
"There are many means of measure. And at this moment, you may well be the biggest person in existence. You've come a long way, my child. So very, very far. You are only the fourth to stand in this place."
The growl rumbled in the dark, a terrible, frightening sound.
"What is that?"
"The Guardian. Except for just a few absences. Extended holidays, so to speak. She has protected this place for eons, since the early days. Fear not. She is merely making her presence known. She doesn't like anyone to get too close to Aluria, my firstborn."
"The tree?"
"Yes, that is the shape Aluria took. She is the mother of trees, plants, and all things green. She also gave birth to animals, all things feathered or furry. And she was my beloved daughter and dearest friend to all who met her.
She's the one who gave Mal... Turin, the fruit, isn't she? The food that granted immortality."
"Yes. And when she did, this became her tomb. The prison Eton sealed, so she was denied my husband's light and rain. In here, she withered and died, while Turin was killing his brothers and sisters. When he finally came to her, it was too late."
"So that's why he challenged his father to combat?"
Bryn asked.
"Yes. And now you must learn the rest of the story. Make yourself comfortable."
Bryn hesitated.
"What about the Guardian? Is it safe for me to sit?"
"Absolutely."
Bryn wasn't about to second-guess Elan herself, so she pulled her legs up
as she would have in the lodge when Maeve began to tell her tale. As she did, the glow of the mushrooms dimmed, and the shadow of the great tree was cast upon the wall opposite Bryn. It stretched upward, looking utterly grand and alive in its silhouette. "First, you have to understand that Turin loved Eluria. We all did. Even Eton. How could anyone not love her? This is what makes the events all the more tragic. Turin arrived covered in the blood of his family. He'd killed all of them and was a terrible sight. What a monster he had become. Eton added the door and left it open so Turin could see what his rebellion had wrought. I suppose he expected Turin to understand the error of his ways, bow down and ask for forgiveness. That's the way of fathers. But of course, Turin no longer saw himself as Eton's son. By then, he was Rex Uberlin, King Great One, and Uberlin didn't bow to anyone. Turin loved Eluria more than anything in the world. I honestly don't think Eton could have done anything to hurt him more. I didn't know what would happen. As it turned out, he went sort of mad. Lost all self-control, and it wasn't as if he had a lot to start with. In his insanity, he challenged Eton to battle. Having murdered his brothers and sisters, Turin intended to do the same to his own father.
"Is that possible?" Bryn asked.
"To destroy the sky? No. Eton is eternal." The light of some of the mushrooms went out, while others lighted and turned red, and on the wall Bryn saw flashes of yellow as other forms of fungi flared near the base of the majestic tree. Then, as the room filled with a ruddy light, the shadow of the tree on the wall appeared to stand amid tears of blood. As she watched, it seemed to Bryn that a haze of smoke drifted across the wall. Violence and sorrow were painted on this mammoth canvas. They appeared as abstract colors and shifting shapes, but Bryn had never experienced anything so disturbing. What she saw was the emotions of hate and sadness depicted with the artistry and beauty of a sunset. "I've never seen such a terrible fight. And I shuddered beneath their blows. Turin had no hope of defeating his father, but the battle raged on and on. Eventually, Turin's madness fled, and his reason returned." Bryn saw a great shadow on the wall in the shape of a man. He was tall, thin, draped in a shimmering robe, and wearing a whipping mantle and a crown of light. In one hand, he held a spear. Then the light softened to a gentle pink. "It's difficult to explain, and maybe only something a mother could see, but I knew Turin wanted Eton to prevail." The shadow on the wall shrank, became smaller and smaller. "I'm not speaking of his desire to die and join his brothers and sisters in pyre. I think he wanted Eton to unmake him. To dissolve him back into the universe. Perhaps my son understood his transgressions and wanted to be punished. Or maybe he just couldn't go on with her death on his hands. The spoiled child who had always gotten his way lost the one thing he cherished most, and nothing he could do would ever change that." In a rage, Turin threw himself against the sky. Eton was unmoved and refused to grant his son anything, not even death. Oblivion would not make up for what Turin had done. Letting Turin die would only allow the child to once more escape his mistakes. The shadow of the king lost its crown as it continued to diminish. The mantle disappeared. The robe vanished. Soon the shadow was of a simple man holding a common spear.
knowing there was no other outcome except for Eton to imprison Turin in Pyre, for that was where my husband put all his unsolvable problems, I stepped in. Too many of my children had been thrown away, and having both murderer and victims in the same place would only serve to harden the divisions, forcing every one of them to suffer eternally. I had to do something, and having seen what I thought was a glimmer of change in Turin, I opposed my husband and defended Turin. Eton saw it as a betrayal. In disgust, he gave up. Then I demanded the key. The light in the room changed to illuminate the little door with a white glow. I knew Turin would want to visit Eluria, but I also knew it was the same key that Eton had used to lock the doors of Pyre, the prison he kept my children in. Even now, I am not sure if Eton understood why I wanted it. He and I, we don't speak much anymore. Father and son have so much in common. They are not fools, but frustration can get the better of them, which makes them unbearably stubborn. Maybe Eton wanted to be done with it all, but perhaps he understood that for a child to grow up, they need to first be granted the ability to fail, and having failed, the opportunity to learn from it. The shadow of the man threw away his spear and sat down. Afterward, Turin remained here, not far from where you are now. He sat and he cried. Ages went by out there while he wept in here. Without his leadership, his people emulated the memory of their murderous missing king. Likewise, the children of Feral, Mara, and Drome found themselves similarly without guidance, lost and afraid. The abandoned remains of Erebus fell into decay and ruin. Bryn watched as the shadow play on the wall continued. The silhouette of the man sat to one side, as in the background Bryn witnessed the destruction of a great and noble city. Towering buildings tilted and fell. The ground shook and broke. Water from the sea rushed in, flooding everything. People fled. Some climbed over mountains, others fought their way through dense forests, and the last group fashioned crude, feeble-looking ships and paddled out into the unknown darkness. The children of Feral, Drome, and Mara fled west across the sea and were scattered in forest, field, and mountain. Turin's followers remained in the east, but left with his legacy, his example, they became cruel, hateful, twisted things. Bryn saw a group of people left behind, and as she watched, they changed shape, becoming bent and hunched, their arms lengthened, fingers sprouting claws. Being the ones to stay, they called themselves the Gazelle, which in their language means both the loyal as well as the forgotten. Deprived of his presence, they no longer served Uberlin as king. They began to worship him as a god. The monsters faded, as did all else, save the small man sitting on the ground. By then, Uberlin was dead. All that remained was Turin. I thought he might never leave. It was clear he wanted to die, but couldn't. The gift that Eluria had once given him, the gift that caused her death, denied him even that solace. Her love kept him alive long after she had passed, long after he wanted it to.
"They all hate me," he said.
"Yes," I replied. "You destroyed their homes, killed their children, taught them war, murder, hate, and revenge. Through your selfishness, you destroyed the world."
"Do you think I don't know that?" he asked.
The reddish light cast by the mushrooms faded and shifted from crimson to purple.
That's when I knew there was a chance. I had been optimistic from the start, but when I heard those words, I knew there was reason for hope. I told him, "Turin, I don't hate you."
"You should," he replied.
On the wall, the man was standing, his head bowed, his body weak.
"You're my son?"
"I am evil."
"You were not born that way."
"But I became so."
"Yes, which means you have the power to unbecome it."
On the wall, the man's head tilted up.
He looked puzzled at that. You have to understand that Turin was never puzzled. He was always so sure of everything. I took this as another good sign.
"How?"
he asked me. "You ruined the world, Turin. Fix it. Make things right."
"I don't know how."
Another good sign, I thought.
The light shifted farther from the red spectrum, becoming more and more blue.
"Then you'll have to learn."
"How? From whom?" "You?"
"No," I told him. "I love you and always will. But I cannot teach this lesson. To learn how to change the hearts of those who hate you, find a teacher. Someone who hates you."
"That should be easy enough," he said.
"Then make them love you."
"I'm not sure that's possible."
"With time, everything is possible. And forever is what you have. It is Eloria's gift and your curse."
The color was a deep blue now, once more revealing the tree. Not the majestic thing it had been, but the broken, withered body it now was.
He stopped speaking then. I could see he'd thought of something, and that brought me joy. Turin had wrought unspeakable evil, but there is no denying that he's a formidable force when he has a goal. He had been on the wrong path, but I feel his feet are now leading him in the right direction. If anyone can fix what he broke, it is he.
Bryn saw the man turn his back to the tree and walk out. He closed the door and locked it with a key that he had on a chain looped over his neck. Then he walked away.
Has he ever come back? Once. His first task was to help those he wronged the most. Feral's children.
Again, the room darkened with the red light. On the wall, shadows fought one another. The room in which Bryn sat was utterly silent. But the imagery was so powerful that she felt she could hear screams of pain and fear and sobs of sorrow. People in a forest beside a river were slaughtering one another.
They were in a terrible state, though Feral would never admit it. She is very much like her brother, and her children followed her example. They fought one another and were nearly erased. That's when Turin appeared. Like a good uncle, he gathered the best and led them west, here, to this place, so they could be as close to Eloria as they could get. As penance, Turin's first act was to give the most sacred site he knew to Feral's children. And then he stayed and taught them to live in peace.
Once more, the red shifted to blue and then to a warm and friendly green. The happy light didn't last long. An instant later, the walls were growing red again.
But then a war came. The children of Drome fought against the children of his twin sister. A war of foolish greed.
Short shadows battled against tall. For a time, it appeared as if the tight, disciplined ranks of the diminutive silhouettes would devour the others. Then the situation shifted. The smaller shadows retreated, dogged by the enemies, who hunted them through forests, fields, and finally, their mountain fortresses.
Pharaoh's offspring gained the advantage, and it was in their power to erase the children of Drom forever. But once more, Turin intervened. He went to the leader of the Frey and invited her inside the sacred grove. He showed Fenelaus the first tree, and he allowed her to see the body of his beloved Eloria, to witness the cost of war and the penalty of hate.
Did she know who he was?
Bryn asked as she stared at the wall, captivated by the image of the tall, noble lady standing beside the thin man, both looking up at the withered remains of the tree. The shadow of the first Fane fell to her knees, crying. She called him Caraticus, the name he'd used centuries before when he fashioned the horn. So she guessed that much. But there's no telling if Fenelaus realized she was speaking to Turin, to Rex Ubalin himself, or if she even knew what those words meant. Still, the visit worked its magic, and Fenelaus spared the Belgriclungrians. The light faded. The images on the wall disappeared.
And that was the last time he came here?
That was the last time anyone did.
But you said I was the fourth.
You pay such close attention.
I'm a keeper of...
I know all about you, love. I remember the sound of your first cry.
While Bryn couldn't see it, she both heard and felt Ilan smile like the first warm day of spring.
Yes, you are indeed the fourth. Turin, of course, is the first. Then he returned with Fenelaus. And the third, the greatest of the great, of course. Eaten exempted from mortality, those he decreed were the most worthy. But by setting the requirement so high, only one has ever met his standards. She is the third to enter this place. You see, the Guardian has been granted the privilege to freely travel both the realms of the living and the dead. As such, she needs no key to enter this place. With just a few brief exceptions, she has guarded Eluria's body, slept on her roots, and kept watch for the end of days, for the Golrok. For you see, it is believed that Turin will unlock Pyre. But as with all rumors, they are easily distorted. Most think that Turin can't stand the fact that there is a realm beyond his control. Those in Pyre are convinced that the creator of war will wage a final campaign against them. And this is what they plan for. It is commonly thought that the start of the final war will begin here. The Guardian will not allow any desecration of Eloria. And for that reason, the greatest hero stands her vigil, guarding the body of my firstborn against any who might do her harm. But given the task that lies before you, she may once again take a leave of absence to offer assistance.
Who is she? Who is this hero?
Bryn heard footsteps. She turned, and a shadow stepped out from behind the trunk of the great tree.
Oh, grandmother of all! It can't be!
Bryn exclaimed, as she immediately recognized the face. The light in the room grew in that joyful reunion as Bryn saw bright blue eyes and snow-white fur.
The world's wisest wolf,
Bryn said, and smiled.
Sorry, wasn't kidding, was she? Did she also know you are the greatest of heroes?
The wolf licked Bryn's face.
Oh, Mina, I've been sent by Malcolm to find Suri. I couldn't hope for a better guide. Will you help me?
The wolf responded by bounding to the little wooden door and scratching at it,
Good luck to you, my dear one, Elan said. And remember, I'll always be with you, no matter where you go.
Bryn walked to the door as the light from the mushrooms faded. She fished out the key, then paused. Bryn wasn't nearly as frightened now that she realized she was a ghost.
What worries can I have? She thought. What harm can befall me on the face of Elan? If an army with spears and swords attacks, what could they do?
Mina scratched on the wood again.
Bryn reached out and was surprised to discover she could touch the door. Actually, touch it. The wood was as real to her as it was to Mina.
Reaching over, she found the walls to be the same. Another scratch.
Okay, okay, Bryn said, and looked for a place to insert the key.
Rain had explained locks when they were at the gate to Rell, but
there's no hole, no place to insert it.
Mina scratched again.
I didn't see what Tressa did when we entered Nifril, but I didn't have to do anything to get into Allison. I only had to have the key with me, and that was enough.
Another scratch, and Bryn noticed the door move. Putting her hand to it, she gave the door a shove and felt it give. A sliver of light entered around the edges. Bryn became giddy at the sight. Not only was the door open, but it was daytime. She hadn't seen the sun in so long. There was reassuring comfort in that yellow light, such that she wanted to bathe in it. She pushed on the door again and noticed something was impeding its swing. With effort, she moved it a bit more.
Mina leapt up and clapped her forepaws against the wood.
The opening grew wider, enough for Bryn to slide out through the gap.
Snow. Everything was covered in winter white, and large, lazy flakes fell through the last rays of a setting sun.
A drift had been pressed against the door.
I've made it. I'm back.
Chapter 14. The Last Meal.
I did everything I could. I jumped, I waved, I shouted and screamed. At one point, I tried to hit her. Anything to get Suri to notice. None of it worked.
The Book of Bryn. Suri stood at the counter, watching Macaretta push the chestnut porridge around on her plate. Imali often made it for the midday meal, frying the leftovers for the evening supper. That day, with Imali gone, Suri had volunteered to cook, since Macaretta had proven herself inept in all endeavors related to food preparation, except for making tea, which to Suri meant she was incapable of doing anything sensible. Imali had explained that Macaretta's upbringing was to blame. She had been raised a Mirilith, and they were taught at a young age to rely on the art, to use it for just about everything. Total immersion was said to be the best way to learn a language, and the art was a tongue of sorts. But it had left Macaretta and many other Mirilith stunted when it came to basic tasks, the least of which is her inability to cook, Imali had once told Suri. Being so removed from the common shared experiences of a normal, natural life, the Mirilith have lost their connection to others. Untethered as they are, and free of traditional drudgeries, it is easy to see why they made the mistake of believing themselves to be superior.
Something wrong with the porridge?
Suri asked, as Macaretta continued nudging her meal around the plate. Macaretta was confused for a moment. Then she noticed her plate and understood.
Oh, no, the food is fine. At least, it's as good as fried chestnut porridge is capable of being. I'm just not hungry. To be honest, my stomach is already filled with butterflies.
Suri stared at her, appalled. Macaretta rolled her eyes.
I didn't eat any butterflies. It's an expression that indicates being nervous or excited, that sort of thing. Honestly, did you really think I ate insects? Aside from the obvious ew factor,
How do you think I managed such a feat? It's winter. There's, like, a foot or more of snow out there. Not a lot of butterflies this time of year. You ought to know better. Didn't you grow up living inside a tree or something? You must know a thing or two about butterflies.
Butterflies, butterflies, butterflies.
The way the word was being thrown about and repeated disturbed Zuri. That word, that idea, carried with it a personal and ominous portent. Whether Margareta knew it or not, Elan was speaking through her.
Filled with butterflies. I didn't eat any butterflies. Not a lot of butterflies this time of year. You must know a thing or two about butterflies.
There are too many mentions to be a coincidence. Is it a warning? An alarm? What is Elan trying to tell me?
That had always been the problem with Elan's discourse. It was never straightforward. Rarely did she say, "Don't step there because the wood is rotted," or "Those berries will make you sick," or "Don't knock down that big fruit you think must be sweet because all the bees are around it." The fruit hadn't been food at all. It had turned out to be the bees' home, and they didn't appreciate Suri whacking it. Now Elan was shouting about butterflies, practically screaming the word at her as if Suri were blind, deaf, and dumb. Suri guessed Elan had decided to break with her tradition of vague innuendo and subtle hints. For years, Suri had been waiting for the time that Arion had foretold, the end of her own Gifford's race. The time she would do the thing she had been meant to do for her entire life. As far as Suri could tell, Elan was jumping up and down and waving her arms and letting her know the time had come.
"Get ready to show off your wings, butterfly."
"Suri?" Margareta was saying.
"What? You all right?"
Yeah.
"I'm fine. I was just thinking about something."
"Yeah, me too."
Margareta looked down at her food for a moment, then asked,
"Have you ever killed anyone?"
Suri frowned as she abandoned the skillet and took a seat opposite the Miralith at the table where she had laid out a meal neither of them would eat.
"Stupid butterflies. I know it's not polite conversation, but..."
She glanced at the drawn drapery.
"In another few minutes it will be dark, and I'll be doing that again. You might have to as well. So I was wondering if you ever had."
"Yes," Suri quietly admitted. "More than once."
"So you know what it feels like?"
"All too well."
"Did you feel..."
Margareta placed palms on her chest.
"Was it like a part of you died?"
Suri nodded.
"And did you feel hollow afterward?"
Again, Suri nodded.
"Are you afraid you lost your soul?"
Suri had been with her up to that point, but this was a sharp turn in a new direction. She didn't even know what a soul was, which would make it pretty hard to know if she'd lost it.
"What do you mean?"
Margareta pushed aside the plate of fried porridge and spread out her hands on the wood as she leaned forward and whispered,
"When I killed the Gwaedrae Jinriel, I felt like a part of me was ripped out. You see, Frey believe that if we kill another of our own kind, Ferrol will banish our soul, prevent us from entering Pyre.
For years, I thought that was a myth or lie used to keep our people in line.
But after I killed Jinriel, I knew it was true.
Priests have blathered on and on about how the afterlife is a place of peace and beauty. But nothing is ever mentioned about what awaits the likes of people like me.
Do I just spend eternity standing alone, listening to the music and laughter I can never reach? Or when my body dies, do I just stop existing?"
She touched her face and arms.
"Is this all that remains of me? And when it's gone, I will be too."
"I don't know," Suri said. She thought about it for a moment and added, "But I don't know of a single thing that stops being. Trees seem to die,
But they come back. Even after they fall down, new shoots spring up. Creeks dry up, but return with the rain. When Tura passed away, I burned her body, but there were still ashes that drifted on the winds. And the stars are always there, following the same course they have always travelled. It's like they take a trip each year and then return. The moon is the same way. It just takes shorter, more frequent trips. Maybe everything does that. Goes away, but eventually comes back.
But now that you've killed, are you afraid of death?
Huh? Suri stared at her, shocked. For a moment, she thought Macaretta might be joking.
Sometimes she did that, made jokes that didn't make sense. The Frey would say something pointless and then break into guffaws for no reason. Suri wondered if this was one of those times, but Macaretta wasn't laughing. She had her serious face on. This was important to her.
No, I'm not scared.
Suri realized the idea was funny after all. The absurd sort of humor, like asking if a person was all right after they had clearly suffered a painful injury.
But she knew Macaretta wasn't joking. Dying is easy. Anyone can do that, Suri said. Living, going on after you've lost those you love, having to face each new day under the weight of their absence, is what's hard. You have to witness a sun that is never again as bright, and hear music that is no longer cheerful. Eating food will never fully satisfy. And you will wake each morning to a shattered world that can never again be whole. Despite this, you have to find a reason to breathe. To move. Suri stared at Macaretta. You've killed, and so have I. But that doesn't compare to losing someone you loved. That's when you really lose a part of yourself. Have you gone through that?
Suri hesitated long enough to give Macaretta time to answer. She didn't.
Try going through that a few times, and I doubt you'll give a damn about what happens to you after you die, because it couldn't possibly be worse.
The two sat in silence.
Then Macaretta said, "The sun is going down. I need to get to the Erinthian. You're going to wait outside on the steps, right?"
Suri nodded.
"And you're going to go in and kill?"
"I don't want to," she said defensively. "I don't have a choice. It's just destiny, I guess."
"You're lucky."
Suri stood and collected the plates.
"I'm still unsure what my fate will eventually be, but I don't think I'll have to wait long."
She glanced toward the draped window. She didn't need to see outside to know the sun was nearing the horizon. They had less than an hour.
"I think a lot will be revealed very soon. Good luck."
"You too,"
Macaretta said. She stood, pivoted on her left heel, and walked to the door, where she took her cloak off a peg.
"I'm sure it will be fine. Emali is smart.
I'm certain she's planned this out perfectly." With that, she left.
Suri cleaned up the dishes and put away the food. No matter how this evening turned out, she had no intention of coming back to this place, and she didn't want anyone to think runes were either messy or lazy.
Then Suri grabbed a cloak off the peg, and as she, too, left Imali's little house, she reflected on how she didn't share Macaretta's confidence in the curator.
Butterflies.
Suri didn't think Elan did, either.
Suri took her time reaching the Erinthian because she expected a crowd. Emali had called the meeting, which would draw the full membership of the Aquila, the Fane, and his entourage, and who knew how many others. While Suri wasn't forbidden from climbing the marble steps, she didn't think it would be smart to be there as all those people walked by. She waited until the Fane and his bodyguards went in, figuring they would be the last to arrive. As Suri climbed the broad steps past fountains and sculptures, the sun's face was fully set, the last hints of light quickly fading. Looking out across the city from that high perch, Suri witnessed a tranquil scene. The cold, dark winter's night didn't invite people to wander, so the streets were empty, and no one gathered in the plaza.
Aside from the sounds of shuffling feet and the murmur of low conversation emanating from the interior of the Erinthian, the evening was as quiet as any other night during that time of year. Suri took a seat on the top step, sitting sideways so her legs dangled while still granting a decent view into the Erinthian. She couldn't see much, just a thin slice of firelight through the door that was left open a crack. Maybe they did that for her. Or perhaps it was just warm inside, with so many people gathered. She could see a bit of them. Tiers of seats, where folks in heavy winter robes sat. Suri had no idea where Macaretta was, but she guessed Imali would be toward the middle. "My last night here," Suri realized, swinging her legs as a smile came to her face. "I can go home after this. The Ghoulgans are going to rue the day when I return to the garden. It will be good to get back." She should be happy, but the idea frightened her a bit, and she bowed her head. "This will be the first time I'll be by myself in the Hawthorne Glen. After Tura died, I still had Mina. I had no idea I'd be away for so long. What will it be like to be back there by myself?" She wouldn't be completely alone. Suri remembered that no one is ever truly alone in a forest. Still, it wouldn't be the same without Tura and Mina. "If I still had Mina, if it was the two of us again, I'd be fine. It's easy being brave with a sister, especially when she's a courageous and wise wolf. Oh, how I miss you, Mina." Suri's eyes refilled with familiar tears when,
yep.
Suri's feet stopped swinging and her head came up. "Mina?" She looked out across the city, searching the streets, then shook her head. "I've done this before." Suri remembered climbing stairs out of Neath, believing Mina was somehow following her. "Must have something to do with the stone stairs. That and wishful thinking. Talking to Macaretta got my mind going, so of course I..."
"Yep."
Suri stood. Below her, a quickly moving figure ran up the street, a fleeting shadow racing toward her.
"Mina?"
She stared down as the shape revealed itself to be a wolf. As it crossed the plaza, the animal was illuminated by one of the lamps, and in its light, Suri could clearly see white fur. A great grin filled Suri's face. "Mina!" At the sound of Suri's voice calling out, the white wolf sprinted to the base of the stairs and charged up the steps, taking them three and four at a time.
"Mina! Oh, Mina! You're back! You came back!"
The wolf leapt to Suri, who threw her arms around her sister's neck. Suri fell onto the marble, hugging the wolf to her. Tears ran down the mystic's cheeks, and she wiped them by burying her face in the wolf's thick fur.
"Oh, Mina," Suri cried. "I can hardly believe it. It's been so long. And here of all places. Oh, Mina, I've missed you so. Are you all right?"
The wolf licked her face. Suri laughed. "Such a wise wolf you are to find me again, coming back to life, just like a river with the rain." The thought came to her, a strange and wonderful notion, like all messages from a land seemed to come from within but were too profound to be homegrown.
"Mina, did you know? Is that why you came to me in the Agave?"
She continued to hug Mina, who licked the mystic's face, cleaning the tears that kept rolling. Inside the Erinthian, Suri heard a hammering, and the murmuring stopped. The Fane was about to give his speech. At that moment, Suri remembered how once, when she was young, she had broken a toe while leaping up a particularly difficult dry riverbed in the Crescent Forest. The pain was incredible, and her eyes watered. What made matters worse was she was miles from the Hawthorne Glen, which meant she'd have a long and painful trip back. As bad as that was, there were storm clouds rolling overhead. Getting wet usually wasn't much more than a nuisance, but at that time, she was in a dry riverbed,
When the rain came, it was fierce, forcing Sori into thick brambles that added to her misery. Worse still, night arrived because, as usual, she had lost track of time. So there she was, struggling in the dark through heavy underbrush with a broken toe in a rainstorm that turned out to be a gully washer.
Why?
The question had come to her as she had hobbled along, wincing in pain. The broken toe had been her fault, bad jump and all. But why did it have to occur right then? This wasn't the first time Sori had noticed this phenomenon. The piling on of bad luck, one hardship coming on the heels of another. Problems were like crowds of people. If a few gathered, several more would surely come. And this pattern wasn't limited to problems. Big events of any sort held an attractive, cumulative aspect. If you plan for something important, then you're guaranteed that a host of unexpected things will pop up. As if major events could only happen at precise moments, so as many incidents as possible squeezed their way in simultaneously. Imali's plan to overthrow the Fane was underway in the Erinthian. The moment they had planned for had finally arrived, so, of course, it was at that precise moment that Mina came back from the dead. As inexplicable as Mina's appearance had seemed at first, Sori realized it was her best friend's death that had been the odder occurrence. That had never felt right. The idea that Sori wouldn't see her sister again had been impossible to believe. Holding tight to Mina's warm bundle of fur was the most normal Sori had felt in years. The how of Mina's return was quickly swept under the who cares rug in favor of the sheer joy that enveloped Sori. It took chaotic, harsh sounds reaching her ears to remind Sori that she and Mina were not the only two that existed. There had been a crash, a great boom, followed by a chorus of screams. Sori glanced through the open door and saw a rush of movement and a flash of fire. She felt she ought to enter and see what was happening, but Mina was there. And besides, Imali had instructed her to stay outside unless called for. Sori would be given the horn, and she'd drop it off with Persephone before heading home. But she wouldn't be alone now. Mina was coming.
Those Gulgans are in for real trouble now.
Chapter 15. Breaking the Law. Some decisions we make ourselves. Some are made for us by others. And some are simply the way it has to be. The Book of Brynn. Wanderlei sat at the front of the Erinthian in Vidar's seat. He had no legal right to the chair, but then neither did Vidar. The pair of seats had always belonged to the Instaria representatives and were redesignated when the newly formed Miralith tribe decided the warriors no longer needed seats on the council. Vidar had left that crucial fact out of the history lesson he had given so many years ago. Wanderlei had been a junior counselor then. Now, there wasn't one. Margareta was hiding somewhere. He couldn't see her, but guessed she'd be toward the rear of the Erinthian, in that forest of massive columns that acted as an impressive backdrop, a sort of dramatic curtain. Wanderlei reached out tentatively with the art, but he only sensed his father and sign. Margareta was blocking. After her exile, she had a lot of practice walling off her powers. Wanderlei kept his eyes on his father, who took his designated seat in the center of the room. Sign stood just off the dais to the left. Her eyes looked like those of a cat searching for prey, pupils swollen as they shifted, darted, studying every face. But her gaze was fixed forward on the most obvious threat. The crowded tiers of attendees dressed in winter hoods. Sile was to the right. The huge bodyguard loomed over Lothian. Someone had finally made armor big enough to fit him, and Sile looked like a wall of bronze. Wanderlei had decided long ago he couldn't be a pureblood, must have been some sort of sick crossbreed. How that had happened, he didn't want to guess. Such an abomination was wrong. The idea that the Fane used Sile as his personal guard was disgusting.
The Fane. My father. This is it.
In a few moments, he would kill his father. Wanderlei would execute the Fane before a packed session of the Aquila and claim his place as their new ruler. His heart was pounding, and he could feel his assica sticking to the sweat on his skin, tugging with each panted breath as the defining moment of his life approached. Imali was relegated to her senior council seat between Volhoric and Nanagal. She leaned over and whispered to her junior, a fellow who already looked old but appeared like a child beside Imali. Many of the councillors were ancient. Wanderlei made a quick check and corrected himself. All of them were old. That had to be part of a larger problem, and something he would correct. Picking the Frey who represented each tribe wasn't normally in the Fane's purview. Historically, councillors were appointed by their tribes, and those selected were almost always the leaders. This current crop had made a fatal mistake that had kept Lothian in power. Had they picked Grindel to be Lothian's challenger, Wanderlei wouldn't have been required to clean up their mess. As far as Wanderlei was concerned, the Fane was endowed by Faerol with absolute power to act in his stead on the face of Elan, and once he replaced his father, changes would be necessary. Imali's plan was simple, as all good plans should be. When the Fane rose to speak, all eyes would be on him, and Macaretta would strike sign, the only real threat. Sitting where he was, Wanderlei had a close and unobstructed view of the Fane. The moment after Macaretta made her surprise attack on Sine, Wanderlei would kill his father. He hadn't decided exactly which weave to use. Fire was his most reliable attack. He felt the most confident with it, but such a weave was so rudimentary that he was concerned his father could easily counter. Wanderlei's advantage was surprise. If done quickly, the Fane wouldn't have time to understand what was happening, much less fight back. It would have to be fire. Wanderlei didn't think he could cast anything else with enough speed. He was nervous, and his hands were shaking so that he tucked them under his thighs. Unsteady hands weren't good for the art. Anything more complicated than a fire weave, and he was certain he'd screw up. He couldn't afford to make a mistake. He had one chance. If he failed, he would be dead. They all would be. Wanderlei remembered what his father had done to Zephyron in the arena, which did nothing to quiet his trembling. Maybe I'm in over my head. People were still climbing tiers and shuffling across rows to their seats. The occasional cough sent an echo over the soft murmur of the congregation. There were more attendees than usual. All the seats, except the one next to Wanderlei, were filled. The balcony was packed, and people were forced to stand two and three deep at the back, peering over one another's shoulders. For a typical winter address, this was unexpected.
How many know what is about to happen? How many came just to see it?
He leaned forward and looked down the line of seats at Imali. She didn't look back. None of them did. Not a single soul in the entire Arenthian looked at him. Again, he had to correct himself. One did. His father. The Fane smiled at his son. An oblivious expression. Wanderlei was struck by his father's blindness. How unaware Lothian was in regard to what was about to happen. This, above all, demonstrated that the Fane wasn't fit to rule. Wanderlei tried to focus on that thought because another idea was knocking to be let in.
He's my father. Does he deserve this? And from his own son?
At that moment, Fane Lothian didn't look monstrous, didn't seem dangerous.
Sitting wrapped in his gold assegai and heavy winter robe, he was just an old Frey who looked cold. His hair was whiter, Wanderley noticed, and new lines adorned his face. New cracks and shattered crevices around his eyes and across his brow. His lips sagged, pinned up by the 2 points of the smile that his son had unwittingly and unintentionally put there. Is he really so terrible that he has to be executed? And must it be at the hands of his son? The Thane stared across the short distance that lay between them. His father trusted Wanderley. He could see that in his eyes. A look that said,
You and me, boy. It's us against the world, you know. You're the only one I can rely on because we're one and the same.
Yes, Wanderley thought. There is pride on his face. Maybe everyone is wrong about him. Isn't he just doing what he thinks is best for all of us?
The moment arrived.
The administrative officer hammered his staff on the marble, and the murmuring quieted.
This 257th meeting of the Aquila in the Age of Lothian is hereby called to order.
The speaker was a tall, thin fellow with a loud but nasal drone.
May our Lord Feral grant us wisdom.
Wanderley watched his father rise, while in his mind, he shouted at him not to. But it was too late. The Thane got to his feet and faced the Aquila.
This winter has been a long one, and it isn't half over, Lothian said.
He sounded exhausted, as if he'd just run from the palace to the chamber. Wanderley was stunned. Nothing happened.
Has Amali called the whole thing off, but didn't have time to tell me?
Relief washed over Wanderley. His father leaned to one side, looking wounded and showing the price each dragon's creation had exacted. While Lothian hadn't personally made any, he had ordered the creation of each one. Wanderley knew this because the Thane communicated with the frontier via Wanderley and Gerrit. Through them, the Thane learned who was to be killed. Wives, husbands, children, lifelong friends, mentors, apprentices, and lovers. Wanderley had witnessed firsthand how his father had spoken to each and thanked them for their sacrifice. In each conversation, the Thane explained how they needed to do their part for the good of the Frey, for Feral, and the survival of their entire race. When none of that was convincing enough, he threatened. The Thane said the chosen victim would die one way or the other, and the loved one's approach was certain to be more merciful. That always did the trick. Wanderley often wondered what his father would actually do if they continued to refuse. Probably nothing, Wanderley concluded. And even though Lothian didn't have to torture the victims, the meetings had taken a toll on him. Now there was a bulwark of dragons along the Nidwalden, and his father bore the weight of each one on his face.
Many of you want to know how the war goes. I am pleased to report that we are launching a major offensive. We finally have enough dragons, and they and an army are gathering in the Harwood. They will lay waste to the Rune encampment at the base of Mount Maedor. After that, we'll sweep south across the burn. Unfortunately, we will need to create more dragons as we go, because they have a limited range, so this will require more sacrifices. Regrettable as that is, I am here to announce that our victory is coming soon. We are already safe from invasion, and the long darkness is near its end.
You have no idea how right you are.
The words were spoken by Macaretta. Wanderley still didn't see her. No one did. But he knew her voice. In his desire to believe the plan had been called off, Wanderley had forgotten she was there. He was listening to his father speak, lost in his words and the familiar normality of the moment. The voice had come from everywhere at once, giving no indication where Margareta was hiding. But talking hadn't been part of the plan. Knowing Sine's prowess for speed, Margareta wasn't supposed to give any hint of her presence. Maybe some part of her rebellious nature couldn't be suppressed. Or perhaps memories of her friends' deaths at Lothian's command had demanded acknowledgement. Margareta was no slouch with the art, and she launched the spell even before her words ceased. For anyone else, Margareta's attack would have landed in plenty of time, but Sine, being who she was, had managed to raise a shield. If Margareta had cast fire, as Mwandale was planning to use, Sine would have lived. But Margareta gave no quarter, no chance. She wasn't relying on half measures. She didn't cast directly on Sine, which rendered her block pointless. Instead, she hit several of the pillars between them, blocks of marble that had taken a thousand fray with ropes and ramps to set into place, rushed toward Lothian's bodyguard with the force of a burst dam. The first slab would have smashed into her face, but the shield deflected it. But personal shields worked best against the purity of a conjured assault. Fire, cold, and lightning, not tons of marble. And the force threw Sine onto her back. The unprotected crown of her head hit the stone floor with a clack, audible to Mwandale from the first row. The impact likely cracked Sine's skull. It certainly broke her concentration, and with it, her shield weave. Lying stunned on the dais, she screamed as the next stone pillar crushed her legs to meal. To her credit, and Mwandale's amazement, she managed to cast one last weave before dying. Before the last of the pillars crushed her. Working in pain and faster than ever before, Sine managed a wind weave that was enough to throw Margareta off her feet. Nothing more happened for a heartbeat. With the air knocked from her lungs, Margareta fell to the floor in full view of everyone. She was just as stunned from the impact as Sine had been. The room gasped. This was Mwandale's moment. The time for him to act. The Thane was facing away. His back turned as he stared in shock at the crushed body of Sine. Mwandale got to his feet along with everyone else. If he took two steps forward and reached out, he could touch his father. At this range, he couldn't possibly miss. And the Thane would have no time to react. But his way wasn't clear.
Is he really so terrible that he has to be executed? And must it be at the hands of his son?
The questions stood between them, blocking Wanderlei's attack.
He's my father!
Margareta! The Thane exclaimed. You! How could...
Sile jingled a symphony of bronze as he strode across the chamber, aiming his spear. At a withered whisper and a hand gesture from Margareta, the bronze began to melt. Sile, that great monster of a fray, screamed as he struggled to rip the armor off his body, even as it charred his skin, before burning through muscle and bone. He shrieked, high-pitched and shrill, like a rat being boiled alive. Margareta looked to Mwandale then. He saw confusion in her eyes.
What are you waiting for? They said.
Then, as Sile collapsed, the Thane raised his hands. Before Mwandale could speak, step forward, or do anything, his father shouted, and he made a gesture as if ripping something invisible apart. In that instant, blood exploded in a singular burst, spraying the white marble. Half of Margareta was thrown across the chamber to slap against one of the braziers, making it wobble. Her torso clapped against a pillar, leaving an ugly red stain. Around Mwandale came screams, whimpers, and tears. People shuffled, moving to get away, to get clear of the violence, to escape. The prince didn't move.
He stood frozen, staring at the blood staining the white pillar as it formed tears that cried. This could be the last night we have. And if it was your father?
Wanderlei focused on Lothian. The Thane was hunched over, breathing hard, and still facing away.
You deserve to die, he whispered under his breath, and cast fire.
Most of the Arenthian had emptied out. Wanderlei knew this, but the thought was only a faint understanding. His eyes and his mind were still fixated on the charred remains of his father. The fire summoned by the art went out several minutes before, but natural flames still flickered in places. His father's hair, that being a Myrilith he should never have grown so long, had burned away in an instant, but his shoes still smoldered. The thick portion of his heels continued to glow, and whenever an errant gust of wind blew, a flame jumped up and danced. Like the remaining embers, his father had refused to die quickly. He had screamed and thrashed. His arms and legs flailed. Blackened, cracked hands slapped the dais until charcoal bits of his fingers broke off, leaving a greasy stain on the marble. As the flames dissipated, his father grew quieter. Soon, the sound of his hissing body was louder than the moans. Then even those ceased, about the same time the flames on his heels finally died. That's when Wanderlei felt the cold. Not a mere chill, nor even an icy wind. Those things came from the outside. This was inside. There was an ache, like that of an empty stomach, only it came from deeper than that. This gaping, frigid winter bloomed in that hallowed space within Wanderlei that was greater than the sum of all his parts. And now that place was as empty as if some internal flame had been snuffed out.
Ferol's law.
Wanderlei placed a groping hand to his chest and looked at his father, at the still smoking body. Then he turned and searched the room for Volhoric. He spotted the high priest fleeing for the door, his heavy cloak whipping side to side as he ran.
Stop! Wanderlei shouted. With a grasping motion, he locked the high priest's legs together. The old Frey fell and skidded to a stop, causing those running behind him to jump over or dodge. One not-so-agile follower stepped on the priest's hand, making Volhoric cry out. He clutched his injured fingers and rolled over, seeing Wanderlei staring at him, the priest's face filled with terror.
Everyone knew I was going to kill Lothian, so why is he so scared of me?
That was the moment realization landed, the truth of the comedy he starred in revealed.
You lied to me! You knew I'd lose my soul, and you lied, Wanderlei shouted at Volhoric.
He heard a pop and sizzle and looked back at the heap on the dais, cooked flesh in the shape of a person that the breeze stirred up. As Wanderlei stared, the full weight of what he'd done landed.
I broke Ferol's law. I'm no longer a Frey, but I'm the Fane. How can the leader of Ferol's children not be a Frey?
Wanderlei struggled to hold his breath against the nauseating smell that was sweet, putrid, and meat-like. The odor was so thick and rich that he could taste it on his tongue as he breathed through his mouth. He crossed the dais to the charred body and ripped the circlet from his father's head, causing the blackened face to rock in protest. Wanderlei put it on and shouted,
I'm Fane now!
The few people still in the Arenthian froze, halting their efforts to escape. They looked his way, every face filled with fear. Almost every face. Imali, who hadn't left her seat until that moment,
Rose.
No, you're not,
she told him, and took a moment to brush the creases out of her purple and white assica.
Of course I am, he shouted. My father is dead. That makes me the Fane.
Imali shook her head, showing him the familiar mentor-like expression that he finally recognized as condescension.
Frey cannot kill Frey. You did. You broke Ferrol's law, so you are no longer Frey. You cannot be Fane.
Wanderlei whirled and pointed at Volhoric, who was still lying on the floor with his legs trapped by the art.
He said there was an exception. He told me Lothian had already revoked his standing as a Frey and could be killed without repercussion.
That's true, Imali said. And as you already pointed out, he lied. Wanderlei glanced at the priest, who struggled to drag himself to the door using only his arms. Then he looked at Imali.
So you knew, too.
You knew, and you convinced me to do it anyway. Why would you do that? Because we cannot be ruled by Myrilith forever, and that was the course that lay before us.
Imali spoke in that same powerful, commanding voice she'd always used when orating to the Aquila.
That was not what Glyndora, what my great-grandmother intended. The Myrilith have tried to vanquish Ferrol and replace him with themselves. Today, we restore our god to his throne and his will to our laws. The horn will be blown by a worthy Frey. One whom... The horn! Wanderlei burst out. That's it! Grindel told me that the Thane of the Frey must be Frey. That there's a crack in Ferrol's law. If I blow it and survive the challenge, I must be reinstated. If I do that, I will be Fane. Where is it?
Imali hesitated. Wanderlei could tell she hadn't expected this. For the first time ever, she looked genuinely concerned. She glanced at Volhoric, still pulling himself across the floor. Wanderlei punched his fist into the air, and the two rows of marble seats just to Imali's left smashed against the walls, cracking the rock.
I have a very long reach, Imali.
Wanderlei glared at her. You were behind this whole thing, weren't you?
All those times we talked.
He sneered at her as the full extent of her betrayal registered. She had deceived Wanderlei for years.
You were only feigning respect. You pretended to help. When all along you were manipulating me to this.
Wanderlei's mouth hung open in disbelief.
I saved you.
He pointed at the far wall.
When the Grey Cloaks attacked and this whole building was about to come down, it was I who saved you.
Imali could have been a marble statue. Not a hint of remorse nor a trace of sympathy appeared on her face.
You saved yourself, or have you forgotten telling me that? I only fanned the flames